CBC News.
In half an hour, In Business finds Peter Day in Iceland, finding out how the country's been hit by financial collapse. That's at 8:30 here on Radio 4. But first, the death of Ian Tomlinson last month's G20 demonstration has focused attention on the policing of protest. Now, in the report, Simon Cox questions the level of surveillance being used against environmental demonstrators.
The government and the police seem to want to get their hands on more and more of our personal details. This week saw a controversial decision to push ahead with an ID card pilot. And today it's emerged that despite a European Court of Human Rights ruling that the DNA database in England, Wales and Northern Ireland was illegal, the data of innocent people may still be held for up to 12 years. Amid claims that we're living in a surveillance society, in the report this week we investigate another method by which the authorities are collecting large amounts of personal data. It's the policing of protest. We reveal how the police are gathering data on environmental protesters who've never committed a crime or even been arrested.
We wouldn't keep data on people who are entirely innocent, but if we see someone associating with another person who is a known criminal with lots of previous convictions associated with environmental protest, then we might be interested to know who that person is.
How the police are ignoring government advice and continuing to use terrorism legislation to target demonstrators.
There shouldn't be a piece of legislation that you can arrest someone who's only got an ice cream recipe on them and who's cycling on their bicycle down a cycle path.
And we hear from innocent campaigners who say they're being branded as domestic extremists on police websites.
This is a bunch of ordinary local people who are trying to protect a lake they love. And the way the police have got things set up, we're domestic extremists.
And we ask whether the police, who should be the referees of peaceful protest, are in some cases abusing powers which are supposed to be there to protect us from violent extremism. Last month's G20 protests were probably the first time that many people had heard of the police tactic of kettling, when officers set up a cordon around protesters and stop anyone entering or leaving. The Metropolitan Police used it several times over the 2 days of the G20 demonstrations. On April the 2nd, Teresa Delaney had taken part in a memorial march for Ian Tomlinson, who died in the previous day's protests, and was outside the Bank of England when she was held in a police cordon.
We'd had a minute's silence for Ian, and then really, with very little warning indeed, we were suddenly surrounded by a cordon of police, riot vans. Slightly later on, the territorial support group turned up and they had police dogs, and it was an extremely kind of intimidating and unpleasant atmosphere within the cordon. The entire experience of kind of being kettled is unpleasant, so it certainly turns the entire atmosphere of the demonstration in a kind of quite dark, unpleasant way.
How long were you in there then, in the cordon?
A couple of hours, I would say.
It wasn't just being held in this way that bothered Teresa, but what she had to do to get out.
We were told that we could leave the kettle if we submitted to a search under Section 60. Section 60 was briefly described to us in that it was because they felt people might be kind of going round the corner to smash windows, which was kind of laughable, and it was made explicit that we would have to give our name and address. Now, my understanding of that law is that the police are entitled to search you under that law, but they're not entitled to take your name, address and other personal details.
And what did you think about having to give that, those personal details when you left?
Very unhappy. I was kind of torn at the time because part of me felt that I wanted to kind of stand up for my civil liberties and say no, but there was also another part of me that was surrounded by police, surrounded by riot police, surrounded by vans, surrounded by dogs, and wanted to go home and not be hit over the head by a police baton in the process.
Teresa's right about the law. The police can ask for your name and address, but you don't have to give it, although most people do. This collecting of personal details, together with the photographing and filming of protesters, has become increasingly common. At the climate camp in 2008, held near King's North coal-fired power station in Kent, it was used on everyone who attended the protest.
Now, I do not wish to stop you from protesting, however, at this time, you are committing a offence.
This was one of the many standoffs between protesters and police at the event. The Kent Force had been expecting trouble, and they'd bussed in around 1,500 officers from around the country. But we've discovered that weeks before the camp took place, the police had set up an intense surveillance and intelligence gathering operation which targeted local residents who'd never broken the law. Like Richard Knox Johnston, who's the chairman of the Council for the Protection of Rural England in Kent and a serving magistrate.
I went to a meeting at Fort Amherst in Chatham about a week before the climate change camp, and it was really just an educational meeting where people were learning about climate change and particularly about coal-fired power stations.
You finish the meeting and then come outside, and what's happening outside?
Well, we just broke up and went home. It was only afterwards that somebody pointed out to me that our photographs had been taken and number plates noted down.
What did you think about that?
Well, at first I found it difficult to believe, and then I was amazed that they felt this was the sort of meeting where they would have any problem whatsoever.
Because of your position of being a magistrate, you don't actually go to protests, do you?
I don't, no. I try and keep away from them for obvious reasons, and certainly I had no inkling that this was likely to be anything other than just a friendly open meeting.
It wasn't just big public meetings that the police were keeping tabs on. We've learned that a residents' group opposed to the King's North power station was also targeted by the police. Trish Marchant was surprised when two officers turned up at a meeting of a dozen local people.
At the time, I was naively assuming that they were there because they were part of the community. And it wasn't until I came outside and I realised there'd been two officers inside and two outside monitoring the comings and goings of the people legitimately attending that I started to think, well, this isn't quite right. I've now got almost an inbuilt prejudice, which I find I have to think about when I speak to officers, because I don't want that prejudice, but I've been pushed into it, and I think that's a real shame.
When they come and sit in your meetings, do you ever say to them, actually, look, we don't want you here, you know, you're affecting us?
Why would you turn to the police and tell them to leave? Because ultimately you've got nothing to hide anyway. There's no reason for them to go. It's just the suspicious way that they turn up uninvited and then don't engage. In fact, at the October residents' meeting in High Howstow, one of the officers had their radio on the whole time, bleeping and speaking away, and we were even too polite as a group of residents to turn the bloody thing off. So that's how tolerant we are.
Trish and Richard told us they've never broken the law, yet they were targeted by the police for openly discussing their concern for the environment and their opposition to a new power plant in the area. So why do the police use what could be seen as intrusive measures? Alan Thomas is an assistant chief constable from Kent Police.
Because we know people feel very strongly about these environmental concerns, that there is the possibility that there will be some outburst, whether it's just unpleasantness or whether it's criminality in these meetings. And so, to be on the prudent side, we do collect information in a discreet way about who's present, so that if there is some problem at a meeting, that we'll know where to start investigating.
The cost element was obviously in both of the policing of the climate camp, but also if you have officers who, I imagine Kent Force is like every other in the country where you have challenging crime issues. If you've got two policemen sitting in a residence meeting for a couple of hours, it just seems like those resources maybe could be used in a slightly more effective way, tackling the kind of crime that people worry about.
I mean, I guess the answer to your question is I need to invest far more in perfect hindsight, because if I knew exactly how everything was going to work out, then I would never waste any officer's time. I would never send them to any activity that wasn't necessary. But I'd far rather be defending the questions that you're asking me now about, you know, have we treated protesters fairly, than defending the proposition that the protest was very successful and they shut the power station down and disconnected the grid locally.
But it's the discreet gathering of this intelligence that can actually cause more concern. Kent magistrate Richard Knox Johnston didn't originally realise he was being monitored. When he did, he wrote to the police to discover what would happen to the data being held on him.
The letter from the Assistant Chief Constable says that if it doesn't form part of the investigation of criminality around the protest, then it's disposed of. But I've since heard that they also can, in certain circumstances, hold on to it for 7 years. And once again, intimidation against people who quite legally are protesting against an application.
It's the uncertainty of knowing what's happening to that data.
I think it is. I think we need a clear and concise ruling from the police of exactly what's going to happen to these records.
So should people like Richard, who've never been arrested or charged, worry that they could end up on police criminal intelligence databases? Assistant Chief Constable Alan Thomas from Kent Police did his best to be reassuring.
We wouldn't keep data on people who are entirely innocent, but what does suspicion consist of? And if we see someone associating with another person who is a known criminal with lots of previous convictions for criminality associated with environmental protest, then we might be interested to know who that person is.
People we've been talking to who, for example, members of the Council for the Protection of Rural England, hardly one of the most radical groups, local residents who I've mentioned earlier on, maybe they have been talking to people who are more active and are maybe more radical, and they could end up on your database.
And I dare say that you and I are both on coming to work and going home 20 or 30 CCTV systems. And
that's not the same. That's a very different analogy. Being on a criminal intelligence database and being on CCTV are two very different things.
Right. So I thought you meant they were concerned that they'd been filmed.
No, the idea that they would be on a criminal intelligence database without ever having been charged or arrested for a crime, but because you might suspect them of being involved with others in some way.
I could imagine some circumstances where someone who has no previous convictions, but where there is very strong suspicion, might find themselves in a data system. It's difficult to see how we could avoid that, because if we strongly suspect that someone is engaged in criminal activities, but haven't enough evidence to charge them, the logical consequence of that argument would be we should dispose of their records. But of course, if we dispose of their records, how will we ever convict them of an offence that we suspect them of?
But you catch them doing it.
Oh, yeah. But then, you know, we suspect you this week of doing something and you're caught 6 months later doing it and you're charged with an offence. Is that a justification for keeping your records now? Or if in 6 months' time you're not caught and charged and convicted of an offence, is that a good reason to delete your records? You know, it's that argument. But if people are genuinely concerned, you know, under the Data Protection Act, they have a right to see what records are held against them, they have a right to find out what it is, and you have a right to challenge it.
They can ask through data protection, but you don't have to tell them, do you?
You know, you're talking really about sort of national security sort of justifications for not being completely frank with people.
This isn't just about the police holding on to data about environmental protesters. It's also about a misuse of the law. The police are continuing to use laws against demonstrators which were never meant for this purpose. Most notably, the Terrorism Act 2000, which allows officers to stop and search anyone within a designated area. For example, the whole of London.
We're sitting around a table with our dinner and various bits of paper and pens, working out plans in terms of where the food's going to be cooked, who's going to drive it where and stuff like that.
Last month, Jonathan Layton, a student and committed environmental activist, was with friends at a cafe in East London, planning the food they'd cook for demonstrators at the G20 climate camp.
I noticed two police officers outside who then came in and announced that we were going to be searched, and before I knew it there were loads more police officers.
And what did they do in terms of the search then?
Yeah, they searched very meticulously. They took pieces of paper that I had that had, for instance, phone numbers on, and they copied that down. They did the standard thing of trying to get your name and your address.
So there's six of you, and then how many police officers come in roughly?
Approximately 10 police officers.
How did you find out about under what powers they were searching you?
Before your search, the police are supposed to give their name, their number, their police station, the legislation they're searching you for. They didn't seem to stick very strictly to this. They told us we were being searched. We then had to inquire under what power they were searching us, and they said the Terrorism Act. We then had to inquire what their police station was, what their names were. I mean, if we thought this was something that was likely to have happened, then we wouldn't have been having a meeting in a cafe in the first place. So obviously it was very surprising and it was very intimidating to realise that they were actually following us that closely.
Section 44 of the 2000 Terrorism Act allows officers to stop and search anyone within a specific area without reasonable suspicion. We wanted to find out how many times the Metropolitan Police had used Section 44 powers at the G20 protests, but they couldn't tell us. We do know that Jonathan's experience wasn't a one-off event. The obligatory backbeat for any self-respecting demonstration, this time the climate camp held at Heathrow Airport in 2007. Shortly before the camp took place, Christina Fraser, one of the organisers, was on a recce when she was stopped by police. She'd previously been arrested for occupying an airport runway several years earlier so was on the police's radar.
We'd basically gone out on our bikes to have a look at the fields. We were cycling along a cycle path on our bicycles, and the police came round and stopped us, flagged us down, and just said they were doing a routine stop and search. But then they ran our names through the name-checking machine, and it came up that I'd had a previous conviction under plain stupid. And then from then, it suddenly switched, and they realised that we were there because of the climate camp. At that point, they said they were arresting us under one of the sections of the Terrorism Act.
This was Section 58 of the Terrorism Act 2000, which makes it an offence to collect information or possess a document likely to be useful to someone committing or plotting an act of terrorism. So what was this incriminating document that led the then 19-year-old Christina to be arrested as a suspected terrorist?
All I had on me was an ice cream recipe.
Ice cream recipe, explain that.
Well, it was just a recipe to make an ice cream. I think it was avocado and cashew nut flavoured ice cream.
And what did you think when they said, we're arresting you under terrorism legislation?
Well, that was terrifying. That was just like, are you mad? I'm clearly not a terrorist. You clearly know that I'm here because of the climate camp. They were quite schizophrenic about it, do you know what I mean? They were like quite friendly and quite like, it's all right, darling, wink, wink, we know you're not really a terrorist. And at other times they'd be like, well, okay, we are using this piece of legislation. We do need to behave accordingly towards this person who's a suspected terrorist.
And what did they do while they were holding you? Did they interview you in that time?
Yeah, they did. I did no comment interview because I hadn't been able to speak to my lawyer. So that was a night in the cell without speaking to anyone, without speaking to my parents. That was the scary thing, that no one knew I was there. And I was like, under this piece of legislation that's for terrorists, you can be kept for 28 days or something. Pretty scary. But then the next day they did let me speak to my solicitor.
She got through to Mike Schwartz, a partner at the lawyers Bindmans, who specialise in defending protesters.
I think it's a shock when people who are clearly not in any way connected with terrorism, however you define it, are stopped, potentially held incommunicado without access to a lawyer or without contacting friends or relatives. That is a shock, though the power exists and, as we know, is being used.
The Home Office says terrorism legislation shouldn't be used to deal with protesters. We wanted to talk to Vernon Coker, the minister responsible for policing, to discuss this and some of the other concerns raised by protesters. But neither he nor any other Home Office minister was available to be interviewed. The police's top cop on domestic extremism did agree to talk to us. Assistant Chief Constable Anton Setchell rarely gives interviews. He's in charge of the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, the National Domestic Extremism Team, and NETCU, the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit. It's a huge remit. So does he think terrorist legislation should be used against demonstrators?
I would not usually expect to see terrorist provisions used with protest, and if somewhere a police commander took a view that it was appropriate to do that, then frankly I think it would be right to expect that individual to justify that use of terrorist provisions. However, if the nature of the protest was around some place that was subject to a potential terrorist threat, then I would say actually it might be proper to afford the officers on the ground those sorts of powers. Wouldn't be beyond the wit of terrorists to blend with an otherwise lawful and legal protest.
Assistant Chief Constable Setchell spent years focusing primarily on violent animal rights protesters and says environmental activists aren't in the same league. But some companies and lawyers don't make that distinction. They're using tactics developed in the fight against animal rights groups to deal with the altogether less aggressive environmental movement.
This is a chart of a number of activists who we say constitute a group. I won't say who they are or their names, but...
In the middle of his chambers is Tim Lawson Cruttendon's war room, with walls of charts plotting the links between the animal rights protesters he spent years fighting. There's also detailed intelligence about his new targets, environmental protest groups. Mr. Lawson Cruttendon is a solicitor advocate whose tactic has been to get injunctions for power companies or airports using the Protection from Harassment Act. If an environmental protester breaches one of these, it's a criminal offence.
It does raise the stakes, and on the whole, civil disobedience protesters do not breach harassment injunctions because the starting point is a custodial sentence. It might only be 7 days, but it is custodial. So if for the sake of argument, you're a school teacher and you feel passionately about the environment, you won't breach a harassment injunction because it has a criminal element to it and because it will ruin your career. The great thing about the Harassment Act is if you go for injunction, you actually have to submit to adjudication by a High Court judge. But that is a good thing because there's a check and balance there and it is a democratic thing to do.
You see those two geese there? They're obviously parading to each other. Well, at dawn, then this lake is completely covered in birds. And that was a great crested grebe, just dived into the water there, right in front of us.
I'm in the middle of the Oxfordshire countryside, just walk down a country lane. With me is Dr. Pete Arbour, who's a retired research physicist and from the Save Radley Lakes campaign. And we're actually on a platform just looking out over one of the lakes, the biggest lake. You might actually be able to hear the occasional quack of some of the ducks and geese that are actually on the lake today. What was the plan that NPower had then in terms of Radley Lake and what they were planning to do with the lakes?
Over the last 20 years or so, the power company obtained permission from the county council to fill these lakes with ash and eventually restore them to agriculture. But by the time they came to the last and most beautiful of the lakes, people put their foot down and said, not this one. And so the Save Radley Lakes campaign was founded to try to prevent, and eventually to succeed to prevent, the power company NPower from filling this beautiful lake with ash.
You had an injunction served against you. What did it mean for you?
I wasn't allowed to walk round the lake. I was deemed to be too dangerous. Eventually I became the only resident of Abingdon who was not allowed to walk round this lake. So it meant an awful lot to me because this is an area I visited for over 30 years. It's been very upsetting, actually.
They say that you had driven your van at some security guards, which is a very serious accusation.
It is a very serious accusation, and I consider it was completely fabricated.
What came of that? Was there any? Were you arrested for that? Were you charged for that?
No, there was no charge made. I mean, you might think that if I had done such a thing, they would make a criminal accusation, but they didn't do that. Under the Protection from Harassment Act, they were able to go to a civil court and just say, using these anonymous guards, that this happened.
Tim Lawson Cruttendon told us the allegations of assault made in this injunction could be sustained. But he says Dr. Harbour was named on the injunction because his local residents' campaign had become involved with a group of hardcore environmental activists who joined the fight to save Radley Lakes.
A number of people squatted the house on Radley Lakes, which belonged to NPower, and started fortifying it and started digging tunnels, putting concrete positions in place. And what was worrying is that NPower found an environmental direct action handbook which suggested that the activists were going to spike their trees. If you put a series of 6-inch nails into a tree and then you have a chainsaw, it makes it very dangerous to cut the trees down. So that the injunction I got, actually, it just protected the integrity of NPower's land, private land, and it didn't stop any protest at all on public land. But we tried to restrict what the activists could carry down the main approach road to the lake. But they couldn't carry hammers and nails or rope or scaffolding bars.
It can be very damaging, though, for those individuals who are named in injunctions, won't they? I know at Radley Lakes, we spoke to one of them retired nuclear physicist and was really, really troubled by that.
Yes, but the trouble is you could have a normal group who are responsible people. But the moment they associate with or get too close to an extreme group, they become part of sort of what I call joint and several action. But once you start associating with an extreme group who actually are squatting the lake, fortifying the lake, and trying to stop NPower from lawfully using their own property, then I'd say that he's gone across the line.
The first time Peter Harbour heard about spiking trees was when he read the injunction. He says he had no idea what it meant, and indeed, there's no evidence that even the so-called hardcore environmentalists carried this out.
These are allegations made by Mr. Lawson Cruttendon.
As well as having that injunction, once that was taken out, you then ended up on the website for NETCU, which is the National Extremism Tactical Unit. Is that right?
I asked to have my name removed from it, and the head of NETCU refused. So I am classified as a domestic extremist, but what's more, the Save Radley Lakes campaign was classified by that writing as a campaign associated with domestic extremism. This is a bunch of ordinary local people who are trying to protect a lake they love. And the way the police have got things set up, we're domestic extremists.
It's a natural assumption to make, but Anton Setchell, the police officer in charge of the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit, says just because your name's on the NETCU website, it doesn't mean you're a domestic extremist.
Injunctions are typically public documents. The protest groups themselves are encouraged and sometimes have been required by judges to put full details of the injunctions onto their public websites, and at the same time for NETCU to put those injunctions onto the NETCU website. I could understand a concern about someone having their name there, but I don't think that their character would be tarnished because of it.
We've spoken to someone, he's a retired academic who ends up on the NETCU website and therefore feels that he's being branded as a domestic extremist, but you wouldn't necessarily see him as a domestic extremist just because he's named on an injunction on that website.
Absolutely not.
Dr. Harbour suffered because he ended up associating with the wrong kind of protester. But what we've found is that if you go to the wrong kind of meeting, to watch a film on climate change maybe, or to talk with other local residents about planning applications, you can end up being monitored by the police. This is in spite of the fact that Assistant Chief Constable Anton Setchell, head of the National Public Order Intelligence Unit, says that the threat from environmental protesters certainly isn't his top priority.
My assessment would be that they do not pose a threat of violence to any individuals, either in society or in companies or organisations that they seek to target. And in my experience, that has been the case.
People will be interested to know, I think, how many domestic environmental protesters are on your radar in terms of people who you think they may cause trouble and we need to keep tabs on them.
I would assess it is far lower than what the public think it is. There is a level of paranoia here on some aspects of what we do, which is completely unjustified and unwarranted.
But that's the perfect way to set the record straight then, isn't it? To reassure those fears that people have of how many people are on those databases.
I can see the argument of it. I mean, the way I would seek to set the record straight is to participate in opportunities such as this to have a conversation about it.
So we don't know how many environmental protesters the police are keeping tabs on. If we had a clearer picture, it might reassure the activists who suspect the police are building up a vast database on them. The police want to be seen as impartial, the referees of protest, but many people we've spoken to feel this is no longer the case. After the events of G20 and the death of Ian Tomlinson, the police have a lot of work to do to regain public trust. One solution might be for forces to be more selective about who they stop, search and film.
The report was presented by Simon Cox and produced by Linda Presley. Iceland was in the news for all the wrong reasons, financial reasons, a few months ago. So how are things there now? In Business investigates in a couple of minutes.
Tell me, Whoopi Goldberg, about the drugs. When did the drugs happen? Because they were in your teenage years.
Yeah. Well, they happened all... they happened a lot, no?
Whoopi Goldberg on Desert Island Discs.
The rough part about it is it wants to...